Tonight on Arena, Cary Fukunaga on directing the new Bond movie No Time to Die, and a documentary on the scientific and literary talents of Awakenings author Oliver Sacks. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, unless you're living under a rock, you'll be aware that the new James Bond film, No Time to Die, opens this week in cinemas. It's the 35th outing for 007 and indeed Daniel Craig's fifth and final time in the role. The film premieres in London tonight, and its arrival into cinemas represents much more than just the opening of another Bond film last year. It was the first big release to be pulled due to COVID, and the film industry will be hoping that it is the feature film to get things back on track, delivering bums on seats in cinemas the world over. The project was not without its problems. Danny Boyle was originally slated to direct. He stepped away, citing, quote, creative differences with producers Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson. In stepped Cary Joji Fukunaga, the director behind True Detective series and with feature films like Beasts of No Nation and Jane Eyre to his name. He took over at the helm of No Time to Die, becoming the first American ever to direct a Bond film. Cary had, in fact, met with Barbara Broccoli and expressed an interest in directing a Bond film before the opportunity unexpectedly came up when Danny Boyle dropped out of Bond 35, as it was called at that stage. And when I spoke to Cary Joji Fukunaga earlier from London, I first asked him what was it about the franchise that attracted him and what did he want to do with it?
A bit of a fan of Daniel Craig's Bond from his first film, from Casino Royale. And I thought that film really brought the Bond films into at least for me on a filmmaking level, the modern world. And it made it brutal and honest, and his character seemed like a real person, like a real assassin struggling with the sort of moral dilemmas of being an assassin that, say, Ian Fleming wrote into some of the original novels and the short stories. And in thinking about taking on a larger sort of tentpole film, you know, within the context of the comic book movies and the Star Wars movies, to me, Bond was much more in my wheelhouse, and I felt like I understood the character and I understood the world he was operating in, and felt like I could add, you know, my little piece to that.
And when the Danny Boyle situation fell through, and you were brought in, you must have been excited first of all. But you were the first American. You are the first American to direct Bond. Were you aware of that at the time, and did that put any kind of pressure on you?
You know, I'd never really thought about my nationality when I was sort of throwing my name in the hat. And I've done, prior to that, I'd done Jane Eyre. Not that that makes me an honorary Brit, but, you know, I had a sense, an understanding of British culture that maybe most Americans don't have. And it didn't feel daunting to me to sort of step into the cultural sphere that he was playing. I think I felt confident. Yeah, I didn't really think about it that much.
Why did you have that knowledge of British culture?
Well, before I did Jane Eyre, I actually moved here because I had a lot of British friends who had been in New York and moved back, and I was looking for just a new experience. So I was living in London for a bit, and that's when I took on the Jane Eyre project. I didn't actually move here for Jane Eyre. I moved here and then did Jane Eyre. And in doing Jane Eyre, I think I became a bit of an Anglophile and really sort of dove into all sides of British culture and history, and found it really fascinating in a way, because although America and England you would think would have a lot in common, they really are quite different places culturally, in terms of rules and the silent rules and traditions. And I found that similarity and the disconnect quite fascinating.
Bond, your watch. It contains a limited radius electromagnetic pulse. It'll short any circuit in a hardwired network if you get close enough.
Mm-hmm. And how strong is it?
It's fairly strong.
Fairly strong? What's that mean?
We haven't had the chance to test it properly. Just be careful. Right, this is QDAR. It will map the space as you move through it. Don't touch that. And Smart Blood will track you. Oops. And your vitals. Bond, you don't mind a shot or two whilst at work, shall we?
Well, I haven't had a drink for 3 or 4 hours.
Wow. Doesn't sound like you.
telling the story then of No Time to Die, how blank was the slate that you had when you did take over from Danny Boyle?
It was pretty blank. Barbara and Michael and Daniel wanted to start from scratch. And that meant really going back to the drawing board. There were certain anchor points of characters and stories they wanted. I think they had also given Danny as sort of a wish list of things to fulfill within the story that I also inherited. But the world, the places, the engine that drove the story were all different.
The thing that a lot of people are speaking about is it's this emotion, I suppose, around that you've spoken about around Daniel Craig and what he brings to the Bond character. How difficult is it to get emotion into an action movie when, you know, you could be forgiven for spending a long time concentrating on let's get these stunts right and that's the important thing?
I think that just comes from my own tastes. Like oftentimes when I watch films that are predominantly driven by action, I tend to tune out in the action sequences. And less so, I'd say, in a Bond film, because so much of the Bond special effects are done, you know, for real and aren't necessarily just VFX, you know, digital life taking over. So in that sense, there's something to lean into. But for my own work, I feel that the action needs to support the story versus having an action sequence or a car chase simply because that's the expectation.
What about the rise of the female agent, which I think is also part of No Time to Die, in particular a new 00 agent in Nomi, played by Lashana Lynch, and Paloma, a character called Paloma, played by Ana de Armas. Was that part of what you wanted to bring to the series too?
Yeah, that was something that I was interested in, but it wasn't necessarily like when I came on board, for example, it was more like, hey, this is my pitch for the movie. It was more listening to Barbara and Michael and Daniel about what they wanted, what they were trying to achieve, what Daniel wanted for the character, what hadn't been working, say, in the previous iterations and or the iteration they were working on, and what they hoped it would be. And then from there, it was, okay, I got all these ingredients. Let me see what I can put together. And definitely from Barbara, there was this desire for this female agent. And I thought it was pretty exciting to try and figure out, you know, within the 00 world, what has been happening with M and his office since Bond has retired.
Shall we cut to the chase?
I'm here as a professional courtesy.
Well, you're not very courteous, are you? You've broken my car. It's Commander Bond. You know that. 00?
2 years.
Very young.
High achiever.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The world's moved on since you retired, Commander Bond. Perhaps you didn't notice.
No, can't say I had. And in my humble opinion, the world doesn't change very much.
You had to say that. Look, this all seems like heaven. This little bubble, or whatever. But it's so obvious you're a man who only has time to kill. Nothing to live for.
And how much did you go back to what you saw in A View to Kill in 1984, which was your very first experience with Bond movies?
I mean, I did use the opportunity of researching this project to meet up with Grace Jones. That was pretty cool.
Why not?
We met up when Barb and I did a scout trip to Jamaica and went to Goldeneye and sat in Ian Fleming's home and sat at his desk where, you know, the character was created, and then had lunch with Grace Jones. And then I also got to go snorkeling with Grace Jones, at which point I think Barbara thought she lost me.
The other aspect of this is when you had when COVID kicked in and everything was delayed and the release was delayed, were you tempted to go back and say, you know what, I'd like to just fiddle with a couple of little bits of editing here?
No, actually. I mean, if I had just had a screenplay and we had this delay, I would have been tinkering to no end. But from the first assembly that we had about 10 days after production wrapped to final cut, which was less than, I want to say, 8 weeks later, I felt really good about the state of the story and the state of the film that we had made. There's always visual effects shots that you wish you had more time with, and I think maybe one or two we did do a polish on, but for all intents and purposes, the movie was done at least a week before the delay was even called.
Daniel Craig has been fulsome in his praise of you, but he is gone now as Bond, or so we're told at any rate. Are you gone as a Bond director, or are you mad keen to get back and do more? And if so, what do you want to do with the franchise?
I've definitely given Barbara and Michael a pitch of what I think could be interesting, but that's really on them to sort of keep that, at least to gatekeep, but also to guide, I should say, the character to the next stage. I am personally interested in doing other things at the moment, but were I to be called back in, if the call was convincing enough, maybe I could come back.
Watch this space, that sounds like to me, Kerry.
Yeah.
Okay, you're not going to tell me anymore. Lovely to speak with you this evening, this afternoon. Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you.
The thing that no one wants to admit is that most people want things to happen to them. We tell each other lies about the fight for free will and independence, but we don't really want that. We want to be told how to live and then die when we are not looking. People want oblivion, and a few of us are born to build it for them. So here I am, their invisible god, sneaking under their skin.
You know that history isn't kind to those who play God.
And you don't? We both eradicate people to make the world a better place. I just want to be a little tidier.
Rami Malek there as the villain Safin, and of course Daniel Craig as Bond in that clip from No Time to Die, which opens in cinemas on Thursday. Music. 2021 sees Music for Galway celebrating its 40th year, bringing the best of Irish and international classical music to the west of Ireland. This Thursday, September the 30th, they launch a series of concerts which will run right through until May of next year. They'll be in various venues, the Town Hall Theatre, the Emily Anderson Hall in NUIG, St Nicholas Church, and all curated by Music for Galway artistic director Finian Collins, who's with me in studio now. Along with him, straight off the plane, practically from her home in the Netherlands, is Dutch soprano Lenneke Ruyten, who will be performing with Finian at the opening gala concert this Thursday, which is at the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. Welcome to you both. 40 years of Music for Galway, I read, Finian. It says that they're intent on viewing this season as the starting point for the next 40 years. That's a lot of work you've lined up ahead of you, isn't it?
Absolutely, Sean. We're only getting started. This organisation is on the up, and we're very honoured to be 40 years old. I've been the artistic director for the last 8 of those, so I'm very indebted to Jane O'Leary and all the other people who came before me. But we are very much in expansion mode, and over the last few years with Galway, European Capital of Culture, and with all the other things we've been doing, we see ourselves as in development and expansion mode, and we have a lot of great plans for the future. So yeah, looking ahead.
And when you're putting together a concert series like this, which is doing two things, I would guess, it's celebrating, obviously, the 40th year, but it also has to be part of that looking forward and maybe pointing in directions you're going to head. Do you have to keep both things in mind?
Absolutely, yeah. And as what we've said is that we're looking ahead very much to the future. We're also looking back, documenting and celebrating what's come before us and how this organisation grew out of the need for better access to classical music, live quality music in Galway, the west of Ireland. Looking back to that, celebrating what's gone ahead, and then also planning for the future and how we continue to grow.
And part of that looking back is inviting back guests that have been here before, and Lenneke is one of those. You've been to Galway a few times, I think, actually, Lenneke, have you? Yeah?
Yes, I've been there a few times. I'm super happy to be back. It's an honour to sing in this concert.
And is there something about... Is it the city? Is it we have a producer from the city who will tell you it is the city. But is it the city, or is it the music that you get to sing when you're in that city?
Well, my main link, of course, is Finian Collins that I work with. We were talking about that for 16 years. We're working together already. So
we started very young.
Yeah. So that is the main link. As the artistic director, he invited me back. But I have great memories of the concerts and the beauty and the walks and all that, the whole atmosphere, basically.
And I guess for a singer, it's really important to find that pianist or an accompanist with whom you can work, where it is very much a partnership, as opposed to, well, I'll play the piano and you do your singing. You really do need to work together.
Yes. It's a very, very, almost, let's say, intimate kind of work. I mean, you have to level up to the max, because a lot of the things you do together, it's in a concert, you don't do it with words. It's a common feeling, a common way of feeling the music. And for instance, he has to breathe with me at the same time, and we are in a flow together, like speeding up, slowing down. And it's a lot of times it happens where you just have to feel each other. You don't always set things up completely on forehand.
Yeah, you can't be very strict, because you need to allow space for everything to breathe and to happen. Mm. It's a very different task, I would guess, Finian, as an accompanist, than it is as a soloist, or even working with an orchestra, as you often do as well.
It's totally different, and it's wonderful. I love working with singers. I love working with Lenica, of course, and the richness of the text brings so much to the experience and the repertoire. I mean, the songs that we get to perform together are just so amazing, and it's almost like a different way of playing the piano, you know, because you're as Lenica says, you're breathing along with the music, you're very much living the text, you're supporting, and then sometimes you've got to shine with big solos, then you've got to become the cushion or the undergrowth or the trees or whatever is happening in the song. You've got to be the knight or there's so much inspiration in what you do.
A couple of artists that you'll be performing as part of the concert, Lenica, not least of whom is Richard Strauss. What a challenge he generally puts to singers in his songs and in his operas.
Yes. Well, I happen to do a lot of Strauss, and actually as a soprano, we are fortunate, because he wrote most of the amazing songs he wrote for his wife. So and she was a soprano, and so he knew exactly how to write well. And so I'm singing a lot of his operas, and I'm singing a lot of his songs. And Strauss and Mozart, they are very alike, because they have so much awareness of the soprano voice that they can make things look difficult and incredible, where it is actually quite lovely for the voice.
So it doesn't stretch the voice, maybe in the way it sounds, it's stretching
exactly,
the voice.
Yes.
There's more ease. Well, you're saying that because you can do it, I guess. There would be others who might argue with you about that particular quality. The piece that I'm going to play, a little piece of a piece called, you can pronounce it for me, Finian.
Zu Eignung.
Can you tell me a little bit about what's been, I think you gave me the translation as dedication before
dedication,
we came here.
Yeah, well, in fact, to say it in one sentence, it's a very big love dedication. So, I mean, it's shiny and brilliant, and it's really warm.
Yeah, so was this written for his wife, about his wife?
Could well be. I will not be sure about that.
Let's listen. This is a recording that that features another great partnership, in terms of, we were talking about accompanists and singers, Barbara Bonney, accompanied here by Malcolm Martineau. Is it easier to listen to it than it is to sing it, perhaps, Lenica?
Well, it's certainly different. I'm enjoying a lot.
As Lenica Royden is with us in studio, along with Finian Collins, this evening ahead of the gala concert for this year's Music for Galway, celebrating its 40th year. Gala concert is this Thursday evening, and they will be performing that piece that we just heard performed by Barbara Bonney and Malcolm Martineau. I'm amazed, Finian, we talked about this idea of soloist versus accompanist. You're also within this gala concert, you'll be doing not essentially a solo piece, but a piano duet. Explain about Mother Goose to us.
Yes, I'm going to play three movements from the delightful Mother Goose Suite by Ravel with another artist who has been coming to Galway for even longer than Lenica, and that is Noriko Ogawa, the wonderful Japanese pianist, prize winner in the Leeds competition in 1987, and a great friend of Music for Galway. And she was just so happy when we wrote to her and said, will you come? We're having this concert. She loves coming to Galway, and she's going to play the Chopin First Ballade as well, solo. Mm. And then with me, we'll play the first three movements of these beautiful pieces written for children, in fact, by Ravel. Mm. And they're absolutely, they're also orchestral pieces, but there's this piano duet
version. piano
as well.
Duet version. Piano so duet two pianos. Yeah. And now Lennox is saying that singing Richard Strauss is very easy. He makes it look very, he makes it look hard, but it's actually really easy. That's what you said. Not letting you off with it. Maurice Ravel, does he make it similarly?
Well, these pieces are very simple, I have to say, pianistically. They're not going to strain your technique, but to get them together and to play them really beautifully and get the right sonority and to be...
There's an atmosphere in them, isn't there?
Yeah, and they tell a story, but so there's a challenge in that alone.
So what is the atmosphere or what is the little story in this?
Well, this one, Les Dronettes Impératrices des Pagodes, is called The Little Ugly Princess. And she's the Empress of the Pagodas. So she's dancing around and there's all these little pagodas. She's taking her bath and they're all dancing around her. So there's a lot of sparkle going up and down the keyboard.
And again, there isn't a recording of yourself and Enrico, but you chose one for us that you suggested we might do.
That's right.
Gabriel
Tacchino
and Emmanuel Stefan.
That's right.
In this recording.
Yes.
So a little flavour there of that third movement from Maurice Ravel's Mother Goose Suite. And that is another of the pieces that Finian Collins will be performing at this gala concert for Music for Galway on Thursday evening. He'll be doing it along with Narika Ogawa on the night. But in that recording we just heard, it was Gabriel Tacchino and Emmanuel Stefan. I was interested to know, while I have you sitting in front of me telling me how easy it is to sing Richard Strauss, Salieri, poor old Salieri. Do you have a soft spot for Salieri? You mentioned Mozart when you were talking about you were talking about Strauss.
Do I have a soft spot? Yeah, I think my soft spot grew a bit for Salieri because I just recorded one of his operas, Armida. I sang the title role. Mm. And that was actually also a bit my discovery of this composer. And I must say that I have been amazed by the colors he reproduces in the orchestra, and it's very, very colorful music, and it's very strong and fantastic music, to be honest.
Because to a large extent, has he been much maligned, obviously, by the film Amadeus, where the suggestion is he was so jealous that in fact he was responsible for Mozart's death. That's the story that's told in that film. Do you think there's any, does that theory hold any water, or is it just a good story?
Well, it's a good story for a movie, that's for sure. But I know that he was fascinated by Mozart and he adored Mozart also. I mean, maybe he was jealous. I don't know so much about that, but I know that he was, fascinated because, you know, Mozart, he was he was incredible. Mm. He was a miracle.
Yeah, he
like
really was.
Every composer next to Mozart
looks plain.
Yes, it's unbelievable. Still nowadays, I mean, if you listen to Mozart music, it is unbelievable what he wrote. So I can imagine, being standing next to him.
I have a recording of you singing some Salieri here. In fact, this is a piece called Armida. Is this from?
Yes.
Is this from one of the operas? What did you maybe give us a context as I listen to a little bit of it?
Yes, Armida. That's the title role I sang. It's the witch that is in love with Rinaldo, and she suffers a lot. So it's a very dramatic role. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, let's have a little listen. Yeah, even as it happened there, that's Lenica Wrighton, who's with us in studio this evening, ahead of her performance at Music for Galway. Now, you're not singing Salieri, although when I listen to that, I wonder, why aren't you singing Salieri? And you'll make me rethink the Amadeus story around him. Finian immediately told us, as we heard the very high note, that it was a...
A high D.
That's pretty up there, really, for a soprano, even for a soprano voice,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. It's well, I'm a high soprano, so the top is easier for me than the bottom of the voice. Mm. So I'm comfortable up there. Yeah.
Finian, just to go back to Music for Galway and acknowledging this 40th year. I know part of the reasoning way back, when you were not involved then, obviously, but the idea in setting up Music for Galway in the first place was to open up the experience of classical music for people in the west of Ireland in particular. How have things changed, do you think, in the meantime, and where are we at now in terms of the sort of infrastructure that we might need in place for the west of the country to get the same share of music as any other part of the country?
Well, I think thanks to Music for Galway, the access to high quality live music has increased enormously in those four decades, and Music for Galway has given rise to further development of the arts in the west, for example, to the Galway Music Residency, which came out of Music for Galway. We've been instrumental in the setting up of the new BA in music at NUI Galway. So we're very much strategic now for the development of the arts in the West. We're not just a small organisation who puts on concerts every now and again. We collaborate with many of the cultural bodies in Galway, but on lunchtime concerts with the university. We're very, you know, connected with the infrastructure. And you mentioned infrastructure as well. And we're also, you know, keen that the actual physical infrastructure of Galway would develop as well. We're agitating for a performance venue for music, dance, performing arts in Galway. There's huge scope for development.
Lots to happen in the coming years. I don't think you and I will be sitting here celebrating the 80th. We might get a few never more. Know, 50th never and the 60th. You never know.
Lenica
Roykin, right, and Finian Collins speaking to be the first concert in the Music for Galway series this Thursday, September the 30th at Town Hall. The next concert will feature Christian Blackshaw playing selected Mozart pieces, who we've been speaking about as well. Regular concerts then throughout the year. You can find out full details on musicforgalway.ie. Oliver Sacks is best known for two extraordinary books on the lives of people living with neurological disorders: The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Awakenings, the book that inspired the film of the same name, starring Robin Williams as the kindly doctor and Robert De Niro as one of his catatonic patients. Oliver Sacks died in 2015, but not before the filmmaker Rick Burns was invited into Sacks' life to make a documentary looking over his extraordinary life and career. Delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by Rick Burns, director of that movie, and Oliver Sacks' life partner, Bill Hayes, who is one of the many contributors to Oliver Sacks, his own life. Bill, maybe you could tell me, first of all, how it came about that this film was even made. Was Oliver very much part of the idea behind it?
Well, it was very serendipitous, actually. Oliver had finished his memoir On the Move around Christmas 2014. And 3 weeks later, he got diagnosed with a terminal cancer. And just 3 weeks later, Rick Burns and his great crew came in and filmed Oliver, interviewing him about his life and talking about this book, On the Move, which covers his whole adult life. But I think Rick can tell a little bit more about how he got involved with this project quickly.
Yeah, starting with that interview that was an interview about a memoir, it became something else quite quickly, Rick.
It did indeed. I mean, I think we kind of knew we didn't have any time to raise money or to really do anything but say yes, given the circumstances that Oliver was in. And we did sort of just charge in and find ourselves in his flat in Horatio Street, where I believe, Bill, you're speaking from now, in Greenwich Village, and began this remarkable 5 days of interviewing between February 9th and February 13th, 2015, just kind of plunging head first into Oliver. And it was not just sort of like Bill was there and his extraordinary editor, Edgar was there, and there were family from Australia and a rotating cast of people who were really the larger family Oliver had drawn around him. And so we were interviewing, in a sense, a man in his own element, which was extremely special to see. And was, you know, we were off to the races with this extraordinary project, which was a story about Oliver Sacks, born 1933, his whole life, but then also a story about Oliver confronting an end-of-life situation. And those two narratives are what shaped our film.
Yeah, and starting at the beginning of that life, Bill, he certainly had an unusual and a challenging enough childhood, I think it's fair to say, is it?
Absolutely. He grew up in a family of physicians, a very brilliant family. But during the war, he was sent off to a boarding school that turned out to be a terrible experience where he was beaten. He was along with his brother Michael, a little bit older than Oliver. And shortly after that experience, Michael had a psychotic break and was diagnosed as schizophrenic, which had a deep, deep impact on Oliver throughout his whole life.
In fact, would you go so far as to say that that incident, as I think the film really claims, that that incident and that experience of his brother Michael was very much part of his decision to pursue a career in and around mental health and a career in that area?
I think absolutely. And the empathy that Oliver had so deeply, I think that's very much linked to Michael, his older brother, who he adored, yet saw go through this very sad, destructive life.
Let's listen to a clip of Oliver himself here describing a conversation that was had with his father. It would have been in and around this time, I suppose, in his late teens when this conversation...
18 years old, yeah.
Yeah, 18 years old when this particular conversation was had that Oliver describes now.
When I turned 18, my father thought this was the time for a serious father-to-son talk. We talked about allowances and money. And then my father got on to what was really worrying him. "You don't seem to have many girlfriends," he said. "Perhaps you prefer boys," he continued. "Yes, I do," I said. "It's just a feeling. I've never done anything." Then I added, "But don't tell Ma. She won't be able to take it." But my father did tell her, and the next morning she came down with a face of thunder, a face I had never seen before. "You are an abomination," she said. "I wish you had never been born." My mother was speaking, though I'm not sure I realized this at the time, out of anguish, as much as accusation. The anguish of a mother who, feeling that she had lost one son to schizophrenia, now feared she was losing another to homosexuality.
Oliver Sacks in a clip there from the documentary film Oliver Sacks' His Own Life. And we're speaking to the director of that movie this evening, Rick Burns, along with Oliver Sacks' life partner, Bill Hayes. That's an extraordinary statement, Rick, that his that Oliver's mother makes. But what's even more extraordinary for me is the empathy that Bill talked about before that clip, that empathy that he has and that understanding that he has of his mother's situation and her reaction.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he was the youngest of four and really the most adored by his mother. As he says in the film, "My mother and I, we were close, perhaps too close." And, you know, when she absolutely in terror and fear and chagrin found out he was gay when he was 18, almost off to Oxford. You know, she had already was a mother, a parent dealing with the schizophrenic breakdown of her third child, Michael. And Oliver's ability, looking back, even as he was administered this searing wound, and I think it's not too much to say it was a lifelong wound, understood the pain it came from his mother, Muriel Landau, who was dealing with, you know, the kind of the explosion of her family life and two of the dearest people to her. So, you know, I think he always understood it. And at the same time, to be abominated by and you know, to have her say, "I wish you had never been born," was, I think, really the thing that sent Oliver off lifelong escape. You know, I think he was on a flight, first from England, from his family, and partly from himself and partly trying to find himself.
Yeah, and he talks a lot about that when we hear him talking about becoming a motorcycle fanatic, a bodybuilder, all of it in some ways trying to run away from what might have been perceived as weakness. If I can be the tough guy, well then, if I look like the tough guy, I am the tough guy. it struck me. But I suppose, Bill, what we should not forget is the society that Oliver was in at that time, the society of the 1950s, where homosexuality was illegal, and his career, his life would have been, you know, a mess if that had become public.
Absolutely. That's such a good point. And it's something really brought out in Rick's film. in the 1950s, when Oliver was a young man, homosexuality was illegal. And that was part of what he was fleeing when he came to America, a land of freedom. But it was also, you know, not safe and not something people considered a good thing for a prominent doctor, a neurologist, to be gay. So he remained very closeted until really nearly the very end of his life, when he did come out publicly, both in his book On the Move and in Rick's remarkable film.
Let us move. I suppose there's a huge turning point in Oliver Sacks's life in and around 1965, 66. He'd been very heavy drug taking, had been involved here, but he realized on New Year's Eve, good night, to realize something like this. I need to change my life. Tomorrow is a new year. Maybe tomorrow is a good day to start thinking about it. And really, from that point on, Rick, a new career and a new aspect to his career really came into being.
That's right. I mean, you can see there's an amazing narrative force to Oliver Sacks' life, where he's kind of resisting even as he's seeking the answers to what's ailing him most. And he had a habit of taking things absolutely to the limit, and then just before everything became crashing down, to make those choices and decisions which would take him on to the next step. In that moment in 1965, where he first quit amphetamines, but also found himself in a kind of a dead-end job in an institution in the Bronx for basically warehoused semi-catatonics and catatonics people, 700 people there, of whom there was a cohort of very, very different people, although you might not have been able to tell. And those people, the people who became the awakenings patients, people who had been in the encephalitis lethargica epidemic of the 1920s and had been essentially locked away and locked in for up almost 40 years in some cases. And Oliver saw and also identified with these patients, saw the possibility of getting inside them, of unlocking who they are, even as in a sense doing so was his own way. Unlocking who he, Oliver, was. So there's this tremendous moment of transformation, which is vocational, but also deeply, deeply personal.
Yeah, and let's listen to a clip that, around that time. Part of how he discovered this way of helping the patients was the use of a drug called L-Dopa and the extraordinary effect it had early on, at any rate, on some of the patients with severe neurological disorders. And one of them was Rose.
And after her awakening in 1969, Rose immediately burst into fluent talk about Gershwin and others who were around in the 1920s. And I asked her, she was a very bright woman, she said, "I know it's 1969, but I feel it's 1926. She said, "I know I'm 64, but I feel I'm 21. At first, nearly all the patients' responses were happy ones. There was an astonishing, festive awakening that summer as they burst into explosive life after having been almost inanimate for decades. But then almost all of them ran into trouble, developing specific side effects of L-Dopa. Sudden and unpredictable fluctuations of response and extreme sensitivity to L-Dopa. What was going on was so complex in both neurological and human terms, I started carrying a tape recorder and a camera, and later a little Super 8 movie camera, because I knew that what I was seeing might never be seen again."
A clip there from the documentary Oliver Sacks, His Own Life. And did Oliver talk much to you about that period in his life? I mean, many people will know it from the film Awakenings, you know, with Robert De Niro as the patient who, I suppose, if you like, is the Rose character in there. Did he talk much about that?
Oh, he absolutely did. That was a turning point in his life. You know, in some ways, it was a very low point. He was working at a chronic disease hospital and literally living at the hospital. But in another way, it was a high point in his life. He had so much time to spend with these patients, living with them, observing them, noticing them, empathizing with them, and absorbing their stories, which he then was able to turn into one of his masterpieces, the book Awakenings.
And that book, Awakenings, Rick, I suppose what we should remember here, he's writing case histories in some ways, which is also what he did in The Man who thought his wife was a hat. He took these case histories and turned them into, it wasn't fiction for sure, but there was a kind of a narrative thrust to it. There was a kind of storytelling involved.
Absolutely. And it was a storytelling that was meant to also be therapeutic. That is, his friend Lawrence Weschler, the writer, points out, you know, for Oliver, narrative was therapy, because these are people, in the case of the encephalitis lethargica patients, who are deeply, deeply locked in. And so to create a story of who they are, in which they recognize themselves in those stories, became a way, as another journalist in our film and another friend of Oliver's, Robert Crawwood, said, Oliver was storying these people back into the world, first and foremost for the patients themselves. And so that way in which story becomes a form of neurological therapy, it becomes a way of connection among people, and also becomes a revelation that, you know, things we hold, think of as being very different, science and art, storytelling and biography, medicine. As far as Oliver was concerned, they were all part of a kind of a chain of empathetic human ambition that he knew in his heart were not divided. They knew were part of a common cause, which had to do with, how do we connect? We people, each of us locked into our own interiority, our own selves, our own subjectivity. And that these are the ways that we make connection among ourselves and create a human community. And I think that that's where neurology and storytelling really kind of joined hands, maybe for the first time since Sigmund Freud.
And you don't talk much about it in your own film, Oliver doesn't mention it along the way. But did he have a reaction, Bill, to the Robin Williams playing of him in that? I know it was a fictionalized version, obviously, of the story. How did he feel about that? Did you meet with Robin Williams? Did he meet with Robin Williams? You weren't there at that time. Did he meet with Robin Williams?
Yeah, they spent a lot of time together, so much time that they became very close friends and had a lifelong friendship. I think he was charmed and delighted by Robin's portrayal in the film. And when I have watched that film since Oliver's death, I'm amazed by how Robin picked up Oliver's mannerisms and gestures. And although there wasn't the British accent, his distinctive British accent, it was as if Robin Williams was embodying the Oliver Sacks that we all knew, the Oliver Sacks who treated those patients. And yes, I did get to meet Robin once, very dear man, so intelligent and so wise and revered Oliver, really, really a beautiful man. And his death was so tragic and really shook Oliver to his core.
Rick, in the telling of this story, in the telling of Oliver's story, was there a particular aspect of Oliver's achievements that you wanted to highlight in the film?
You know, I think that kind of coherence that ran throughout his life, you know, which had a narrative quality, was also to be found in, I think, the thing that he was sort of wonderstruck from the moment he first was aware he was Oliver as a little boy. This extraordinary miracle, which is the consciousness endowed all living beings. We have a sense of self, which we, each of us, has unique access to. And Oliver was thunderstruck by that and sometimes terrified by that, and deeply, deeply curious in a scientific way. Where does this miraculous thing, selfhood, consciousness, come from? And that ran through all of Oliver's life. It ran through his work with his patients. It ran through his writing and was right up there to the very end. And so I think what was really astonishing was to see this tremendous consistency of wonder, which kind of illuminated Oliver's being from beginning to the very end, which is, where does this thing come? One of his friends, the neuroscientist Christoph Koch, said, you know, there are three fundamental questions science addresses. Why is the world? You know, where do we all come from? Where does life come from? And what's the origin of consciousness? And that third, scientists are pretty much of a piece about, is the hard problem. That is the hardest of the three to begin to come to terms with. That was really Oliver's life mission, and to be able to share that in a kind of a study of Oliver's life there at the very end was incredibly special.
I want to ask you, Bill, about the Botanic Gardens in New York. But before we do that, let's find out why I want to ask about that. We're going to hear your voice first of all, and then we'll hear Oliver.
In 2008, Oliver and I had this little correspondence, and I'd paid a couple of visits on my trips to New York. but I didn't know he was gay. And it wasn't until I moved here and we began to see more of each other that we developed a relationship. I think, in a way, as unexpected for me as for him, Oliver had lived this very solitary life and not had any long-term relationships.
We started to go out together, often to the New York Botanical Garden, which I had visited alone for more than 40 years. It has been a great and unexpected gift in my old age, after a lifetime of keeping at a distance.
So, Bill Hayes, you know, when you hear about those gardens, what memories come back to you in and around yourself and Oliver?
Well, of our weekly walks at the Botanical Garden, it was his favorite place. It was right near the hospital where he had worked in the Bronx, and we would make that drive usually on Sunday mornings early. And Oliver could expatiate on every species of fern. He knew that garden like his own home.
For you, it was the initial meeting. Was it through work, in fact, Bill?
Our meeting, Oliver's and mine?
Yes.
Yes, it was in the most old-fashioned way. I was living in San Francisco at the time, and he read one of my books, a book called The Anatomist, which tells the story behind the classic 19th century text, Gray's Anatomy, a book that he had grown up with in his household, his parents both being physicians. Mm. And he read my book and wrote me a letter and just saying, congratulations, Mr. Hayes, I read your book, I enjoyed it. And so I wrote a letter back and we had a brief correspondence. That's really how we first got to know one another. And then about a year later, for reasons unrelated to Oliver, I moved to New York City. And at that time, we met in person and pretty quickly we fell in love.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's very clear, even from the way you speak about it in the film. One thing I want to finish up with, and I'll ask you about this and how you think Oliver might feel about it, Bill. There's a wonderful line early on. I think Mark Honimoff, if I'm saying his name correctly, a medical doctor, he talks about people, the patients of Oliver, that he storied them back into the world. I thought it was an incredible phrase. What do you think Oliver would think of that phrase, and how do you think that describes his work?
I think it's such a beautiful, beautiful description of his work and so true. It's also true of Rick Burns' remarkable documentary, which to me is almost like a cinematic case history of Oliver Sacks and telling his story in his own words with this remarkable archival footage, filling it out. It's just a really beautiful film. Happy that people get to see it.
Well, Rick Burns and Bill Hayes, thanks so much for speaking to us this evening. The film, Oliver Sacks' Own Life, will show at The View in Dublin for a special screening event tomorrow, September the 29th, and then it will open at the IFI in Dublin on October the 1st. Arena. And that is it for Tuesday night's Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1.